Channing and McKenzie here, and you're listening to Freshman Founders,
a podcast for people who are interested in starting their first business and want to know how it really works.
Whether you're a business major, interested in the startup lifestyle, or passionate about making a particular change in the world,
this podcast is the one for you. Welcome back to Freshman Founders. Final episode of season two. We've been waiting for this moment for a very long time.
It is time for Q&A.
So we've gathered some questions that you emailed us or that we just received from students that we've talked to at colleges and just a lot of questions that we've gotten a lot recently. So without further ado, the first question is, how important is culture when you only have a few employees?
It's really interesting because I you always hear about these companies that now have, 50 to even 100 employees, and they've really been able to lock in with, I think at the beginning, those employees are what build the culture. So that's why it's so important what even those first couple of hires look like, because you're really kind of hiring more founder mindsets at the beginning, even that like 0 to 25 marker.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. I never thought culture was that big of a deal. You know, people make a pretty big deal about it in some companies, or obviously good culture makes it a good place to work. But I never really thought that would be a big deal for us until we had at least 15 employees or so. And then we would kind of figure out what our culture was. But I think you kind of have to start right away, even just with just the two of us founders.
Absolutely.
We needed to kind of lay some things in line that we at least kind of had things that we need to stick to and things that we wouldn't bend on, for example.
Yeah. And it's funny because just today I was talking about, with someone that culture is really, I think, stems from your mission statement and your moral values as a company. And I think that culture gets this low-key rap of like, oh, it's ping pong tables and beer. And I think we're even all kind of over that a little bit from the startup craze and like the cool factor. But I mean, no, culture and your mission statement is, what do you guys care about as a group? And what do you want to put your time towards? And how do you want to respond? And how do you want to react to things that happen throughout your day? Something that, I even think about is, what if someone is having a really tough day? It's like, how do the rest of us respond to that? And how do we help them? Like, I think that's culture.
And culture too is allowing your employees to be open enough with you and hopefully with each other that if there is a problem between people, if everybody has an issue with one person or thing in the company and they feel like they can't talk to you about it, I think that's not great culture, and that's only going to hurt the company in the long run.
Totally. And I think what we've learned a lot about is that if we are okay to ask the questions of our team and our employees to say, how can we make this better? What is working for you? What is not? It's then we're just getting feedback on how we can improve that culture. So if anything, I think really the employees, the question was, how important is culture when you only have a few employees? Well, I think it's everything because I think it's your team.
Yeah. Next question is, how do I start saying no to customers and transition to better customers?
Oh my.
Wow. We talk about this a lot.
Like today.
Yeah. And it's really hard because when you're getting started, you want to say yes to every opportunity and you never want to turn anyone or anything down because you're just getting started and you have the time to say yes to everything. But there is definitely a pivotal point in a business when you have to start saying no to opportunities and to even customers and in fact, turn away opportunities to make money. Which sounds crazy, but it's the only way you're really going to grow as a business.
An imperfect way for me that I use the rule of thumb method of determining, are these customers right for us is I first start with my gut. You can tell so much by just what actually do you feel about this path you're going down with this kind of customer? Does it even just throwing it on a wall make sense that you're working with them? But then I love to back that up by actual analytics and metrics of saying, okay, let's actually look at the funnel and see what kind of revenue is coming through, see how many hours we have to put towards them, what is the actual gain, what is the actual net value, and then how many times does that do they come back and return that, and then what is the, you know, what is that overall return? And right there, I think we're going to answer a lot of those questions of how do we start saying no, it just physically and monetarily does not make sense.
In our business, when we transitioned away from college customers to more corporate customers, it was a huge change, obviously, in the customer that we're selling to. Totally different types of people are sold to in different ways, respond to us in different ways. But we saw what a massive opportunity there was on the corporate side of things that wasn't there with college. And it was just kind of a no-brainer. There was some college customers we kept around for a while, but we just actively made a choice to not pursue those types of customers anymore. And at some point, we just kind of phased out those customers. Mm-hmm. And it was really worth it, honestly. I mean, they weren't bringing us nearly as much money and taking a lot more time. So it was a pretty easy decision.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, we don't really think about it this way because we are all in business trying so hard to make this work for our customers and to get paid. But it really needs to be a symbiotic and mutual relationship where both parties are coming back at the end of the day, wanting to work together. So you're so right. It was very clear when we phase out and it stays phased out, maybe that wasn't the right one.
And I think a lot of times too, those customers that take all of your time and are probably not paying you a lot of money are the people that value you the least, weirdly enough. Like they are just a time suck and they don't even understand how much of your time they're taking and they don't care. They're just, they're in it for themselves. They want what they want. And as soon as it's over, they're just like, see you later, goodbye. And you are just left feeling terrible and not having made enough money for it to be worth it.
Man, I'm so glad this question was asked today because it's something that I was talking to our team about today that I was even personally struggling with. So that's a great reminder. And then, okay, so awesome question, in my opinion. The next one is, there are so many opportunities for me to grow. How do I know which path to take in my business?
With this one, it's really hard just getting started and seeing that you could have maybe five different business models and to kind of pick which one is the one to focus on. It's hard to say, you know, which one's always best right away, but I think, especially when getting started, do need to at least have like one main business model. It's reoccurring revenue streams are great and having multiple streams of revenue are great, but I don't think you can tackle five at once. I think you really do need to have one focus, especially getting started. And then maybe you can bring in some of those other streams of revenue a few years into the business once you really have figured out your core model. Listening to the customer too is the biggest point that you need to, you know, you need to see where the most business is, where the most money is, and are you going to enjoy that path too? That's a big part of it.
The next question is, how important is it to be transparent with pricing? I have a very cut and dry perspective on this. I think, especially in today's world, it is, I think, absolutely necessary to be transparent with pricing because we have found that it's also yet another qualifier for your leads with your customers. If you are kind of hazy on your pricing, you're not only having that customer maybe feel a little questioning of you and, well, why are they not showcasing their price point to me? But also what we have found is if we are not showcasing our pricing, they might even think it's their view on what our price is and our view on our price. It could be totally different numbers. They could be like, oh man, this is probably like, you know, thousands of dollars to do this X. And for us, really, it's a couple hundred. But if you can showcase that price point, then if they're saying yes to that, they're already so much more qualified and they're ready, you know, to buy if they're moving forward. Whereas if you, you know, get that person to see it and they had a lower budget in mind and they can't afford you, great. You know, maybe that's not the right customer for you. So that's my opinion. Kenz, what do you think?
Yeah, I think there's certainly some times when you maybe don't have to be super transparent and not that you're lying or being deceitful to a customer, but that, you know, they don't need to know what your product costs you to make and what every margin is. I don't think you know, not every business operates that way. And so with us, since we're providing a service of artists performing, artists are different than maybe a lawyer or someone who charges by the hour, who has a fee that they are going to charge and you know exactly what you're paying. Artists are different. It depends. Do they have to travel? Do they have to bring sound equipment? Is it a full band? Is it a solo act? You know, all these things come into play when the price is decided upon. So we often start with the event planner's budget and kind of work backwards. It makes things a lot easier, but they still know exactly where the money is going and who is getting paid what with our business.
That's a great point, and actually how we work.
Yeah. It's tricky. I mean, I would just say in overall, don't try and deceive your customer. Think of it this way. If your customer was presented a super transparent layout of who's getting paid what in your business and they would be appalled, then maybe, you know, you should adjust that a little bit. Like, you never want it to be like you're hiding something from them. And if you are, if your business works on you keeping that price point from your customer or from somebody in a way, then that's kind of scary. And you could really get in a lot of trouble and be quote unquote found out in a way. And you probably will, like you probably would be exposed. And there's lots of opportunities for people to find out from other customers or from going to a competitor of yours that might be more transparent. You know, they might just feel better about that. Even if it's the same exact price, they probably will feel more secure about knowing where the money is going than not.
Next question is, people are used to being consistently sold to. How do I actually break through the mold with digital sales?
Yeah, that's really hard. We see ads all the time, all day, every day. We see an ad. I mean, you could type in something and see an ad for it within the next few minutes on your browser, on your Instagram. So easy to click through or not read into ads or even your email. You know, you get emails now that you're like, this person doesn't know me. This person is just trying to sell to me. I'm not going to read this. And so it's really hard to stand out to people because, you know, most businesses, you don't get to talk to your customer one-on-one. Every single sale isn't a conversation. You are trying to sell them with a digital ad or with email marketing. So it's tough.
I think it also, it depends. You know, we talk a lot about, okay, are you a product? Are you a service? Are you a product with a service? And for us, to make an example out of it, is Evermore's platform is a product, but we can, you know, service people as well through our product experience. And something that we've been really thinking about is, you also, you know, your buyer at the end use case, you know, we have to also look at those emotional indicators and those buying habits and what intrinsically motivates them. Now, our buyer actually sometimes they need to purchase, you know, from us for their job. Well, you know, that doesn't, maybe their job isn't what intrinsically motivates them. So we try to think of characteristics and traits that our service and our product can help them with. Things that we consistently get back with studies is, you know, that we can provide peace of mind. We can provide, you know, comfort and safety and trust. And so thinking about how can you promote those things rather than just being like, hey, $10.99, like, you know, just that kind of consistent marketing, actually break through the noise. I feel like that's so cliche, but really start thinking about them as people, not just them as customers.
What's really worked for us too is being as personal as possible, even through digital marketing and conveying our story and what matters to us. Because if that lines up with what matters to them, they're so much more likely to buy. And if we can somehow get in front of people and be honest and say, this is who we are, this is why we're doing it, this is what we sell, but, you know, really, this is the why. This is why we're doing it. We want to make your life easier. And we've come up with a solution to do that. So, you know, buy from us. We're trying to help you.
As you guys know, Mackenzie and I, we went to Belmont University and we took entrepreneurship classes together and learned, you know, some of the key points of how to build a business there. And we're so thankful that the Belmont University Center for Entrepreneurship is sponsoring Freshman Founders. And the Center of Entrepreneurship has tons of resources to support student entrepreneurs, such as 2 on-campus co-working spaces, competitions throughout the year, free business building clinics, and mentorship and grant opportunities.
Belmont is also ranked by the Princeton Review as one of the top 25 entrepreneurship programs in the nation, and the only one in Tennessee. The Center for Entrepreneurship guides students through every phase of their entrepreneurial journey, beginning their freshman year and lasting a lifetime. How do you know when a hire isn't working?
Oh, this question is, it's so hard because there's so many factors. Something that we've even heard, you know, like our mentor say is like, okay, how long did it take you? Now, granted, you know, you as the founder may have had to like forage the path to figure out a process that works. That's obviously going to take you a long amount of time. But like now, what kind of sales cycle do you have? So it's going to take maybe a couple of months for that person to get up to speed, but then they need to be, you know, they need to be rocking at the same pace as you are based on what role it is. Now, granted, I'm naturally thinking, you know, more of sales and biz dev right now, but it really, yeah. I mean, the same goes for a developer, the same goes for marketing. Like they need to be able to get onboarded quickly. And I also think just something to think about, this is a little off topic, but with hiring, some great advice that we've gotten, especially when you're in startup mode, is or first-time founders, really don't only think about the person that you're hiring as the right person in that field, but also one that has that the ability to operate, but then also have a bigger picture for the organization and be able to think like a founder. Like you're basically hiring another founding member. And, you know, when it's those first couple, it's the culture. It's everything.
Yeah. And I honestly think you'll just kind of know when things aren't working too. Like you're not going to be blindsided that this wasn't working. You probably have known for a while and are trying to think of how you can make it work when it just, and there's instances where you can make it work if maybe it's not working. But I think if you start to feel that something's not right, this isn't working, they're not performing how I expected, you're usually pretty right about that. And I would say, you know, fire fast and learn as quickly as possible because they're wasting your money and your company's money by not performing and they're wasting everybody's time. So just get them out of there. Like it's okay, but get somebody better in that role. And the best people for your company, you'll know too, just as much as you'll know who isn't good, you'll know who is good. And you might not even have a role open for that type of person or like ready to go, but you just know that person is, you want to work with them and you think they would bring value, do it. You know, bring that person on and find a position for them because the right people are going to make your business grow so much faster and more efficient than the wrong people.
Absolutely. And I think too, something that we started doing well, you know, even just recently in the past couple of months, was we stopped trying to just look for the right people for certain roles, you know, because that's such a shot in the dark. Instead, we also started being open and receptive to just great people. And like Mackenzie said, like, let that role define itself if it's meant to be there. Like, there's a couple people that have come into our lives and even more, and it's like, this person is so good at X, Y, and Z. We weren't thinking that'd be a role right now, but what if we can test it out? What if we can hire slow? What if we can make it work? And what if we can start making decent revenue from that? Then maybe this great person could be a part of our team sooner than we think.
I'm reading a really good book right now that has a lot of great tips about hiring and knowing the right people. Something that really stuck with me is when you start to feel the need to micromanage is the time when you realize they're not right for you. The person that you do hire, I mean, that's a huge risk that you're taking on as a small company, having somebody paying for somebody else's salary. So they need to be performing. You know, you can't go easy on that person because that affects your business, which you've built from the scratch and you've worked hard on. So, you know, don't go easy on them. Don't give them more than enough time. They should want to succeed and believe in your vision. And that's where you're going to see the best results.
We have 2 questions left. So the second to last is time management with investor relations can be tricky and it can be a full-time job. Yes, we agree. The question is, how much time should it take?
Yeah, this is, unfortunately, it really is a full-time job raising money. Thankfully, there's two of us founders in this company. I feel for everybody that is a solo founder, I don't know how you do it. Channing has really taken this role on in our business, as in finding investors, vetting them. It's super important to vet investors. You know, you're not the only one that needs to be vetted because it is a partnership.
It's like getting an STD test on both sides. Just saying.
Seriously, like you're matching with this person. You're taking that money. They have expectations, but it takes forever. I would plan at least 6 months out if you know you're going to need to raise money. Start looking.
Absolutely. It really depends what kind of scale of investment you're looking for. But man, it's crazy. It's like, it's kind of like back to customers. The customer with the smallest budget can sometimes be the trickiest. Same thing, most, you know, timely. And same goes for investors. You know, that angel, and that's why we have to vet and we have to prep. And now a question, in a first meeting with a potential investor, I do not leave that meeting without saying, you know, what other investments have you made? What are your relationships with those entrepreneurs? How often do you talk to them? What are your expectations of them? And what do you expect for updates? Because it's just so good to right off the bat know their expectations to see if that aligns with yours. It's not that you don't want to do everything and more for them, but the whole reason they're investing is that you're running this business and you need to keep running it.
Yeah. If they want to have way more control than you're comfortable with, that's a pretty good sign to not take their money.
And again, the gut feeling, gut check is so huge. I can't tell you. I mean, you know, and Mackenzie and I, there's been many times where we have a conversation and we're like, this just doesn't feel right. And so we say, no, it's okay. It's okay to go off of your gut because that's what, you know, you have to live with every day. So
I think it depends if it's an angel or a VC too. VCs definitely are more efficient. That's literally all they do. They know what questions to ask. So you'll find out quicker with those types of investors if it's going to work or not. Like they'll kind of say no earlier on. Obviously, it could still take 6 months or so, and then you still get a no, which sucks. But usually quicker than angels, you'll find out if that's going to work. Angels, since they're people, they're more flexible on what they want, what they're asking, what they're curious about. They might want to know every little thing about your whole business and want to know all your numbers, then they're going to take way more of your time.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think it depends where you are as a business as well. Because, I mean, when we first started out, you know, we were not ignorant to the fact that, you know, we really were first-time founders right out of school. And there was operational, you know, functionality that we just did not have. And so we honestly looked for angels that could provide some of that and had the bandwidth to do that. But now it's like we need more of a silent partner who's really pumped. We can give them those updates. And then we can, you know, just keep rocking.
The final question is, how do you split equity with first-time founders? A lot of people who start a business together just go in 50-50. And I think that is not the move more often than not. I think that if that's going to be the case, you really have to know that you're on the same page. And it's just about time. Are you both going to spend the same amount of time on this? Is one of you doing this full time? Is one of you doing this part time? That should be definitely a big say in who gets more. I mean, if somebody is, maybe even somebody is using their own money to help start the business, they probably should get more equity. It just depends on what kind of role each founder is going to play.
When we were starting out, we were both so on the same page, more so than even other, you know, team members. And so we felt confident that we could count on each other and we could go in on this 50-50. But something to just, you know, take note of is that a lot of investors want to see that there is a final decision you know, maker. Mm-hmm. And even if it's just a couple points more,
yep.
they want to know that it can be done. And even if you guys both agree, awesome. They want to be able to, like, investors and potential acquisitions, they're always thinking of how can we make easy decisions? Is management correctly put in place? Are there processes in place? So just be thinking about that too.
Yeah, we actually did structure it where we didn't have exactly the same amount. And the when we first really started, we even had a third partner that also had a different amount. And it wasn't that different, but it was just enough to say, hey, bottom line, if we cannot make a decision, that person is kind of going to be the final decision maker. And they're going to be also responsible for the outcomes of those things too. We fortunately have never not been able to work something out where that like had to come into play. We've always been able to talk things through and then one of us is able to convince the other, but I'm sure not everybody communicates as well as we've learned to. So it's good to have maybe some difference in equity, I would think.
Yeah. Bonus question, because a big part of our business is communication. I mean, true. how would you recommend improving communication lines between business partners?
It's crazy how important it is. It's really a relationship. It's a marriage. It's like we talk about things more than I've talked to anybody in my life about anything else. And because we have to be on the same page in every aspect of our relationship as friends. You know, we are friends. We are business partners. So those do tie into each other. You know, we do compartmentalize pretty well, but we have to make sure that we're solid with each other, that we're both feeling the same way about the business. So I say just the fact, like, we have like weekly check-ins, if not more, you know, we talk about every aspect of the business and just make sure that, hey, you know, we haven't talked about our new hires in a while. How are you feeling about them? Do you think they're delivering as well as I do? Things like that. Just checking in, because not everybody communicates as well as everyone else. You know, people communicate very differently. So just making an active choice to communicate, however that looks. Just, I don't love talking about my feelings or anything like that either, but you kind of have to put your pride aside and be like, you know what? We do have to talk this through. I'm not feeling so hot about this aspect of the business. Let's figure it out.
You know, as we're getting bigger, we're starting to pay attention to what company culture looks like in larger groups so we can, you know, prepare for that and implement right now. And I'm very just surprised that that's not really a part of larger organizations.
Yeah.
And now, granted, I know that we are unique and we started as friends and grew this, but we were even talking to, you know, one of our new sales hires. And, you know, we were just talking about like life. Like, there was a lot of tough stuff going on last week. And, you know, they said, they were like, man, like, probably shouldn't be talking about that. And we're like, no, it's life. Like, we have to like, everyone needs to know if it's okay to know what's going on. So we can, because guess what? I'm not going to treat you differently, but I definitely might, you know, take extra care in how I say something or in this moment. I don't know. I think it's like human nature to be careful about that.
We just want to be good people and we want to work with good people and feel like the people that work for us like us and want to work for us. I mean, that's rainbows and butterflies, but like, that's also what's going to deliver the best results. Like that people that are feel respected and that feel like they can talk and communicate openly about things, whether it's totally business or totally personal, you're going to feel better about your job and you're going to be a better employee. Sweet. Well, that's all the questions for the season. And with that, we wrap it up and we will have to see you next time around.
Yeah, and just wanted to say thank you so much for listening to season 2. We had a great time doing this and we loved all of the people we brought in as guests.
Yeah.
It was our first time doing that and we just wanted to bring some experts in and we definitely learned a lot too. So we're excited to keep you updated on plans for the next season. It will definitely be different as we like to switch it up, but also would love your feedback on what would you want to see more of. So thank you for the questions and much love.